Today, The Guardian's Beijing Bureau Chief Lily Kuo answers your questions about how China has coped with coronavirus and what life is like there now. So, Lily, where are you at the moment?
I'm in Shanghai.
And what is life in Shanghai like today?
Well, today the weather was really great. You know, it's starting to be spring. There were a lot of people out. I noticed a lot of people wearing face masks, but I also noticed a lot of people with their face masks sort of half on or kind of pulled down just to, I don't know, feel the breeze on their face or just because they were chatting on the phone or talking to somebody.
A casual face mask.
Right, right. Just sort of half hanging off their faces.
On the 19th of March, China recorded its first day without new locally transmitted coronavirus cases since the pandemic began. After weeks of living in lockdown, restrictions are being eased in an attempt to try and get the country back to normal. But there are concerns that China's data might not be as accurate as they're claiming. And with reports that Tokyo and Hong Kong are bracing themselves for a fresh wave of cases, some are asking whether China may be lifting its restrictions too quickly in a bid to restart its economy. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, what can we learn from China's handling of coronavirus? We're now in lockdown in the UK for a few weeks at least, and just as Wuhan and other parts of China are emerging from theirs. But what did lockdown in different parts of China actually mean? Because it was different in different places, wasn't it?
Right. It was different in different places. It was also different in different residential compounds and different kind of areas of the city that you lived in.
Lily Kuo is The Guardian's Beijing bureau chief.
The strictest lockdowns were in Wuhan and the surrounding cities and counties, and there people couldn't leave their apartments or their homes. Some people were able to go outside a little bit, like just kind of within the grounds of your apartment block or your compound, but most people just had to stay inside. You couldn't go out to get groceries yourself. The sort of neighborhood committee was supposed to organize that for you. So this was a big problem. If you needed to get to the hospital, then you were supposed to arrange transport to this neighborhood committee, and they were overwhelmed. In other cities, they implemented what was called wartime measures. And so buildings were sealed and people couldn't leave their homes. And if you left your home and you were on the street, the police reserved the right to detain you and charge you for disobeying the rules. And then in places like Beijing, there were checkpoints everywhere for cars. If you were trying to get into a shopping center or a residential district, you would be checked. You'd have your temperature taken. You'd often have to scan a QR code or an app that would record your information, or you would have to write down your information. In Beijing, at the time, there weren't that many cases, not as much as there were in Hubei, but it was still very strict. And you couldn't have people over to your home. So Beijing, it wasn't a full-on lockdown, but there were just all these restrictions on movement. Then also, people just decided to stay in a lot. Like, my cousin in Shanghai, he didn't leave his apartment for 30 days.
Really?
Just yeah, right. He gets a little bit obsessed with, I guess, numbers or goals. So I think it was kind of a feat for him to see how far he could get.
Definitely. I think one of the complicated things here at the moment for people is how much should you be going out, and the idea of not going out at all, not even to do exercise or only to do limited exercise, I think really worries people.
Right.
How long did people in parts of China think this was going to last for, and how did they react when these measures were imposed?
When it first happened, I think people were totally shocked and it was very sudden. And when the lockdown happened in Wuhan, people there were also very angry too. This thinking of how long was this going on for? How long did we know about this? And why were there not measures taken before it got to this point? Which seems very similar to thinking now around the world.
Yeah, I think that we're all human and people react, you know, in similar ways to being told that they can't do certain things.
But one thing that I think is interesting is it seemed to me that people in China, and I was also in Taiwan and Hong Kong when this was happening, and it just seems like people were much more willing to do social distancing or take measures like wear face masks than they are in the West. And I don't really know why that is.
Yeah, that does seem to be a cultural difference that's playing out at the moment. I mean, here, when we were told this week that it was going to be a 3-week lockdown, a lot of people have got really panicky and stressed about that. I mean, when people knew how long it was going to be in China, were they angry?
I don't think people did know how long it would be, though. It was indefinite, right? You know, they just said, it's on lockdown and we'll let you know when it gets better.
I think one question, Lily, that a lot of people in the UK would like to know the answer to is, how did people in China cope with this lockdown? What practical things did they do to get through it?
I think people spent a lot of time on their phones and people communicated a lot with each other over their phones. So I talked with somebody the other day who said that every day her and her friends would just chat all day. And she said that at one point somebody said in this group chat, you know, it's really nice that we can talk every day, that we have all this time to talk. So I think people are really relying on communicating with other people, because chatting through these apps and playing games and stuff, they don't feel as alone.
Yeah, I chatted with a group of friends last night, and we haven't all sat and chatted together, I don't think, for over 2 years. I don't know if you found this, but you really find yourself actually reconnecting with people.
Yeah, and you start, I don't know, messaging people you haven't talked to in a long time just to see how they are. You know, somebody else said something like, you know, just take this time to take care of yourself and your family, because a lot of people are stuck at home with their families.
And very few people, Lily, could go out and work. How are they financially supporting themselves? And did they get any help from the government with that?
A lot of people were worried about their incomes. When the virus hit in China, it happened right as people were getting ready for the Chinese New Year holiday. So the country was basically shut down anyway for, you know, half a month to a month. So that just extended. So people didn't have income for an even longer amount of time.
And have the government stepped in at all to help individuals and businesses?
So they've done things like they're putting more money into infrastructure projects, which are supposed to create jobs. I think taxes are supposed to be reduced on small businesses. And I think there's some measures for loan payments to be deferred for individual families and businesses also. So there's some efforts to help people out.
Okay, so we've talked about what lockdown was like for people in their homes, but how was it actually enforced? And one of our listeners, Chloe Boyes, wants to know about surveillance in China. How was it used, and did it help, do you think, to speed up the lockdown process?
So when I think about the surveillance measures, I guess I'm referring to these apps that now everybody has to use. And those were rolled out later. The one that's used most right now is a health code, and it gives you one of three colors, yellow, green, red. Green means safe, you're good to go. This is based on your travel history, if you've had any symptoms. Red, obviously, is you're not safe to leave. And yellow means that you're possibly dangerous. So what's interesting is that people were seeing their codes change to yellow, and they didn't know why. But that would be enough to mean that they weren't allowed in certain places, or that they were told to go back home. People are worried that these apps are not transparent in how they're using this personal data.
Yeah, and Chloe actually also wanted to know whether people who were given red or amber codes have been impacted by this more adversely than people who perhaps might have a green code.
Oh, definitely, because they have to stay home and they're not allowed in places. You know, they just have to stay home and wait for their code to change. One of the other issues with these systems is that if your code becomes yellow or red and you don't know why, you don't really have recourse to ask for it to be changed. And there's also some concern that the information in this app, this health code app, is being sent to the local police.
That sounds really scary. How did they enforce the lockdown?
The lockdown was mainly enforced by manpower. China has this, they call it a grid management system. So a city would be divided into smaller areas, and then there's a range of people that are charged with monitoring these areas. I think at the beginning, actually, it was mainly police. It was neighborhood committees that were overseeing the lockdown and making sure people were following the rules. The government's ability to corral and mobilize so many people definitely helped to do this very massive operation. Also, they always said that if you didn't follow the rules, that you could be detained and that you would be punished according to the law. And people do know how punitive things can be here. So I think that that meant that people followed the rules a bit more closely.
What would happen if you didn't obey the rules?
I was looking recently at a number of verdicts related to the virus, and people were sentenced to jail for 6 months for hindering prevention measures.
And do you think those draconian measures, you know, locking people down, not letting them out of their homes with tough punishments if they did, do you think they have been successful?
I don't think that those were necessarily the measures that enabled China to contain the virus. After the lockdown in Wuhan, a little while later, they started to impose very aggressive and more systematic quarantine. They would trace all the contacts of a confirmed case and they would put them in quarantine centers and makeshift hospitals to isolate them from the rest of the community. One of the issues with the lockdown is that there were a lot of family clusters. A lot of people went home to their families after they were tested positive for the virus or while they were waiting for their test results, and then they just infected other people in their homes. And so that was another reason why there were so many infections. So once they started this process of putting people in schools or hotels or gyms that had been converted into these makeshift hospitals and quarantine centers, that helped prevent some of that community spread.
What about testing?
At the beginning, there was a big shortage of tests, and that a lot of people were complaining about that. But they dramatically increased the number of tests that they were doing a day. So I think it went from maybe a couple hundred to around 7,000 a day.
Wow, that's a huge increase. And that's something that here we've been very slow and people are very unhappy about the low levels of testing. What do people in China think about the way that the UK has responded to this virus so far?
People were really fascinated by the herd immunity idea when that was first being floated. And there were some people that were impressed by it and then other people that were shocked by it and just thought that it was very unreasonable and inhumane.
Obviously, we've now taken a change of tact.
Right. I think if on the government level, there is this feeling that now China's methods have been vindicated and that these measures that people were describing as draconian and a violation of human rights and limiting people's freedom of movements were too much. And now there's this feeling of, look, now you're doing it. And it did work.
After this, Lily describes how China is trying to get back to some sort of normality. But first, a quick request from us. Today in Focus, we'd love to hear your views about the wider world of podcasts, which will help us to shape the future of Guardian Audio. As a thank you for your contribution, there will be a chance for you to win a John Lewis voucher worth £250. If you'd like to be entered into the prize draw, the only personal detail we'll take from you is an email address. So if you'd like to help us with this, you can find the survey on guardiansurveys.com/podcast or click on the link to the survey on the homepage for this episode at theguardian.com/todayinfocus. Thanks. Okay, so the Chinese government are feeling vindicated, but what's actually changing in the country?
We're seeing restrictions lifted basically across the country. I guess the biggest indicator that things are changing is the fact that restrictions are being lifted in Hubei province. And just recently, they have announced when Wuhan will lift its lockdown pretty much completely, and that's April 8th. According to the official statistics, we're now seeing almost zero local transmission. Every day there are new cases, but all of those cases are imported infections. A lot of them are overseas Chinese who are coming back or students coming back from overseas who have been infected.
Because there's been a lot of questions about the reliability of this data. David Cotter got in touch to ask whether the reported drop in COVID-19 infections is just a hiatus before the disease becomes prevalent again. What do you think?
There is a lot of worry about a second wave of infections, especially as the country gets back to work and people stop staying at home and people are back out again, and also with the number of imported cases. Public health experts and citizens in China, people that are on the ground down in Wuhan and Hubei, they will all say that, yes, the situation has improved dramatically and things are much better. But whether or not there are absolutely no new local infections is something that a lot of people don't completely buy. And this week also, we saw Premier Li Keqiang give orders to local governments across the country not to cover up new infection numbers just for the sake of maintaining a zero local transmission rate. So we don't have hard data to show that the numbers aren't right or reason to think that they might be dramatically much higher, but there are definitely some doubts about them.
Is anyone in China pushing back against lifting this lockdown now?
Some people are worried about going back to work, but because they don't really have a choice in it, there is not that much pushback. So there's a sense of resignation that if the government wants to lift the lockdown and get the economy restarted, then that's what's going to happen.
That sounds like quite a stark choice, Lily. But what are they actually basing this on? How are they counting cases in China?
In China, only those who test positive and show symptoms are counted as confirmed cases. And they don't disclose how many asymptomatic cases there are.
Wow.
Asymptomatic cases are included in another category. The WHO says that they're not a main point of transmission. One thing that's different is that China tests people who don't have symptoms. So they test all the close contacts of somebody who has been confirmed with the virus. But in other places, I think in the US, if you don't have symptoms, they don't test you. So I guess that's part of their justification for that. One of the problems that the Chinese government has now is that the initial cover-ups and suppression of information has really led to a lot of public mistrust.
You mentioned mistrust in government, and some of our listeners, Lily, have asked us how all of this will impact on Xi Jinping. Could this damage his leadership internally and internationally, do you think?
So at the beginning and in the middle of it, I think a lot of people thought that might be the case. And the fact that the virus has been mostly contained and also the fact that it's so bad everywhere else is really a win for Xi Jinping and the Communist Party and their leadership. And they're really pushing this idea that, you know, we beat the virus and, you know, now we're the ones helping other countries as they deal with this.
Yeah, we've seen China really take on this role, haven't we, as a kind of global leader on supporting others during the coronavirus crisis.
Yeah, definitely. They sent shipments of supplies and medics to Italy. And I believe that Italy said that that was the first overseas aid that they had received. They're setting up a lab in Iraq. They sent supplies to Iran. I think they recently pledged to send supplies and help to Spain, Cambodia, the Philippines, I mean, Serbia, really everywhere.
That's really interesting that you say that Xi's leadership has potentially been strengthened now because China seems to be coming out the other side. But could this depend on how well the Chinese economy recovers from this?
Definitely. It depends on if the country is able to balance going back to work without a rebound in infections.
A lot of people in the UK, Lily, are looking at the next few weeks and working out how to get through it. And the big question here is how long this is all going to go on for. But I think people are also wondering what our lives will be like after this and how different they might feel. And one of our listeners, Nikki, got in touch to ask about the long-term impact of social distancing and isolation. She wonders if it's made people in China less trusting of others that they come into contact with. How do you think that's played out?
So on the one hand, there is an amount of wariness of other people. There's been more wariness of foreigners coming in because people are worried about imported cases. And I've talked to somebody who said that a foreigner sat down in the subway and the woman next to him just went and stood on the other side.
So, oh no, that's so sad.
But on the other side, I would say that I think people are also realizing how much they need each other and how much they value things that they took for granted before. So people in Wuhan have talked about little things like going to the movies with their husband and their kid, things that they didn't even think about. Now they realize how special that is. And people saying things like, oh, I used to be one of those people that never wanted to go out and just always would stay home. And now every day I'm waiting for the chance to just get outside, you know, that one trip to the grocery store or something. So I'm not sure that people will be more isolated or will trust each other less.
When you're walking around Shanghai at the moment, do you feel people are being more friendly than perhaps they were before?
No, not really.
Maybe it's like London was.
I think these big cities, you know, people are still just like, who are you? Get out of my way.
What emotional impact do you think this had on everybody?
So that's something I keep asking people, and I think it's something that I'm interested in, because it seems like when something like this happens, a whole country or a city like Wuhan, I mean, it leaves scars, right? You know, there must be this sort of city-wide or province-wide trauma. And I've been curious what that looks like. And for some people, I think they will just go back to work and go back to life as usual. I think other people have had their sense of trust and faith in their governments very dented, and that's been changed quite drastically.
And some people have lost loved ones, of course.
Yeah, and then just the amount of people that lost loved ones. And that's something that, I don't know, just the numbers, you know, more than 3,000 people, and that's how many people died in China. If you think about that number of people, once you include all those family members, how many people is that that's affected? There was an interview with a doctor. She was a doctor in Wuhan in the emergency room, and she described some of the moments that she saw as things that she'll never forget for the rest of her life. And I wonder how, for people like that, how that changes them for the rest of their lives.
How are you feeling about what the country has been and is still to an extent going through?
This epidemic has been huge for China, and the toll that it's taken on the country in infections, in deaths, in economic impact, the impact on just individual people and their lives is staggering. And it might be still a long time before we can fully appreciate how big of an impact this has had on this country.
Lily, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Lily Kuo. You can read all of her reporting from China at theguardian.com. Thank you to everyone who's left reviews of the podcast this week. We read through all of them yesterday, and they really do mean a lot to us. Next Friday, we're speaking to our writers who review TV, music, and books. So please send us your questions. Maybe you want to know what you should be reading right now, or the best songs to make you feel happy when things are getting a bit tough. Send them at theguardian.com/COVID-19 questions, or tweet Anushka or myself. We are at Anushka Astana and at Rachel_Hump. Thanks to everyone who sent us questions for today's episode. It was produced by Courtney Youssef, and the sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you have a great weekend, and we'll be back with you on Monday.